For many years, the Woodstock album and movie kind of crystallized Jimmy's performance, the Star Spangled Banner and Purple Haze particularly, as the highlight of that original festival. I think for many, many people, their memory of Woodstock and Jimi Hendrix is intertwined. So it's an important release for people. It's a touchstone for people of Jimmy's generation, and I think for young fans, they look at it. It's one of those iconic moments where they're saying, you know, if I get one Jimi Hendrix live album, it's probably going to be live at Woodstock.
And it was just a sea of people. By this point, of course, the fences have come down. We must have been 350,000, 400,000 people. And I was standing next to Bill Graham, and he turned to me and said, you know, Eddie, if these kids riot, we're dead. I said, thank you very much, Bill. I'm going back to my truck now. This is Eddie Kramer. I was Jimi Hendrix's engineer and producer, and you're in the studio with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock.
Until recently, the closest I ever came to the musical genius of Jimi Hendrix was in a converted cornfield in Northwest Ohio. No, Hendrix wasn't actually there, but I sure was, sitting in a high school buddy's car at a drive-in movie theater. And up there on the silver screen, a couple of years after the actual original Woodstock Peace and Music Festival occurred in mid-August 1969, was a film of the colorfully adorned Jimi Hendrix performing the Star-Spangled Banner as the sun rose over the crowd on the final day at Woodstock. The visual image and the sonic bombast of the brief film appearance is permanently etched in rock folklore. But it turns out there was more, much more, never released until now. Jimi Hendrix headlining the original Woodstock Festival. His complete 140-minute set is now available. Hendrix biographer John McDermott, author of two Hendrix books, sets the stage.
Well, by the spring and summer of 1969, the original three-piece Jimi Hendrix experience, which was Jimmy, Mitch Mitchell on drums, and Noel Redding as the bassist, they're probably the one of the biggest acts in the world. They certainly were the highest grossing act as a concert attraction, particularly in the United States. They're one of the first groups who were able to sell out sports arenas and headline major festivals. And I think that 3 years of intense touring wore apart the unity that had been there when they launched the band in October 66. You know, the Jimi Hendrix Experience was not a group of friends who rallied together and, you know, joined a band and, made a pact to be together forever. Chas Chandler brought Jimi Hendrix over to London from Greenwich Village and auditioned what he thought were the best available bass and drummers for Jimmy. So it was a made band, put together band that became a tremendous overnight success. By the time June 69 came around, as successful as they were, I think Noel Redding felt stifled, that he did not have a creative role in the group, and he decided to leave for a group of friends in a band called Fat Mattress, and the experience, as it were, broke up. In June of 69, their last performance was at the Denver Pop Festival. Hendrix then went upstate to New York in the Woodstock town of Shokan and just wanted to write and refocus. And I think at that point, there were a number of people that came in. Billy Cox was his old friend from the Army and from the Chitlin Circuit. Ultimately, they recruited Larry Lee, a second guitar player who also, like Cox, had played on Stax Sessions and other R&B and blues records from the South. Mitch Mitchell stayed around because, you know, he was part of the experience. Jimmy was introduced to a couple of percussion players, which brought a different type of a flavor to his sound. And they were in that house up there just rehearsing and trying new material. And Jimmy was trying to really get his next musical direction set on course. Well, one gig that had been on the schedule was Woodstock, ironically. You know, he did an appearance on The Tonight Show in that summer and really just it was laying low, but Woodstock was on the docket. And so they ultimately started turning those rehearsals into, you know, serious work. And the Woodstock Festival was their debut.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Originally on the Jimi Hendrix Experience's second album, Axis, Bold as Love, that's a spirited version of Spanish Castle Magic, newly restored from Hendrix's Woodstock appearance. Wisely, the organizers of the Woodstock Festival had the foresight to arrange for the event to be documented on film and the music recorded. Here's Hendrix recording engineer and veteran rock producer, Eddie Kramer.
I was asked to join the film company up at Woodstock and record this festival. I think they picked me because I was in the middle of an album with Jimi Hendrix, and of course they thought that, well, you know, since Jimi is going to headline, you might as well get the guy who's working with Jimi and see if he wants to record the whole thing. And that was it. I don't think anybody knew it was going to be more than a gig. I think there was a sense possibly of something about to happen. If you look at the political climate, look at what has happened in America in that particular time. I mean, we're in the midst of the Vietnam War, lots of protests, you know, the hippie movement, the flower power, all that sort of thing. This was a sort of a gathering together and a celebration of that. And you kind of got a sense that, well, something's going to happen here. You know, Woodstock, let's get all the kids together and have a big concert. Well, you kind of knew by the names that were being bandied about that, well, this is going to be interesting. This is going to be fun. Might as well film it. Might as well record it.
After original experienced bass player Noel Redding quit in a huff in the June of 69, Hendrix took the opportunity to experiment beyond the restrictions of the three-piece lineup. But Jimmy's old army buddy, Billy Cox, reminds us that Hendrix's management did not encourage Jimmy's new band.
He wanted to get into a little more percussion, rhythm, bluesier, and he was constantly growing. I was listening to him. He was growing and growing and growing. And he felt that the other band could not grow in the areas that he wanted to grow in. So he, you know, he reached out for me. He reached out for Larry Lee, who was one of the greatest guitar players I know of, who helped Jimmy get his theory together. We already had, Mitch Mitchell, who was probably one of the greatest drummers alive today. Then he added percussion to give the rhythmic breathing to the music. And that was the area that he really wanted to go. But however, there were those who says, no, we can't have it this way. You can do this gig, but that's not what it's all about. If it's not broken, don't fix it. So we did the Woodstock, which to me, my opinion is that it's probably one of the greatest gigs that Jimmy ever did.
We'll be right back.
Originally on the revolutionary Hendrix debut album, Are You Experienced? That's Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock with Foxy Lady. Up next, find out the conditions under which Hendrix, bass player Billy Cox, and recording engineer Eddie Kramer had to perform. I'm Red Beard. In the studio, Jimi Hendrix, live at Woodstock. Hendrix biographer John McDermott reminds us that the Woodstock Festival, whose legend has grown to mythic proportion, was probably viewed much more pragmatically by Hendrix.
Well, I think the thing about Woodstock that's interesting in Hendrix's career is that he was the artist they had selected to close the festival. He was debuting a new band, and, you know, it was somewhat of a risky venture for him. But I think that it was something that, you know, he did not place a great deal of significance, like many people did not, until Woodstock actually happened. And I think that, you know, the movie, for many people, made it seem as if there were a 500,000 people there and that it was, you know, an incredible performance. And, you know, that really stoked the legacy of Jimmy at Woodstock. And I think that what we've tried to do with this record is realize that, you know, hey, he didn't get on until Monday morning when many people had already left. He was with a band that, you know, this was their first major performance. And so there were moments where things, you know, weren't as cohesive as they were with the Experience. But he was trying material that he had never played with the Experience. So there's something to be said for that. So it's a fascinating performance. I will say that if you listen to this particular performance, you hear arrangements and soloing and playing that Jimmy never really played ever again. Certainly not with those players, apart from Cox and Mitchell, who he played with in 1970. But he never played with a big band concept like that ever again.
Son. You don't care for me, I don't care about that. You got a new fool, I'm not good like that. I've only one itch and desire. Let me stand next to you. Let me stand. Listen here, baby. Back is so damn crazy. Hey, your mama ain't home and ain't mama, son. To play with me and you won't get burned. I've only one itch in his eye. Let me stand next to you. Oh, let me stand. I ain't gonna give you too much, huh? Oh, I'm over. Let Jimmy take off. Talk about me.
Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock with Fire, performed Monday morning as the sun rose over Max Yasker's farm, the site of the original Woodstock Festival. According to Hendrix recording engineer, producer Eddie Kramer, it's a miracle that this recorded icon even exists.
When I arrived there on that Friday morning at about 5:30 a.m. and saw the sun come up over an incompleted stage with the scaffolding still going up, and I thought, there's no bloody way in hell that this thing is going to work. and I realized by 12 noon that we still weren't on the air. And particularly when I walked out into the audience of about, must have been 200,000 by that point. That's my rough guess. And I went to where the PA was going to be operated from, and it was still being worked on. The console was up in the air. Smoke was pouring from it. Guys were soldering wires, and I thought, you know, there is just no way we're going to get on the air. But eventually, we did. By 1 o'clock, I think Richie Havens opened up, as you well know. But there was really a sort of a spirit of adventure and what the hell? We're in this now. We might as well just stick it out.
Bass player Billy Cox reveals one of Jimi Hendrix's techniques that was both practical and brilliant.
We tuned at half a step down, which enabled him to reach some of those notes and bend the strings in a particular way. Now, I questioned that. And then he said, remember how we, oh yeah, we've only got two instruments on stage. Then at Woodstock, we had Larry Lee. So we didn't have a keyboard or horns or strings, so we could all tune down to E-flat with no serious ramifications. His vocal range in a pocket that he could control, at least a half step, that goes a long way. It made his strings a little more pliable, whereby he could do a lot of bending, because the standard tuning, they're a little stiff. He had huge hands. He was an exception. He was born to be a guitar player. Large hands. His hands were incredible. He could have been a basketball player. Could palm a basketball. Easy. He was born to be a guitar player. He was born to be Jimi Hendrix. And I think he knew that. He knew he had that edge.
Meanwhile, back at the Woodstock stage on opening day, Hendrix recording engineer Eddie Kramer reported that conditions were state-of-the-art. As long as the art was finger painting.
It was a disaster right from the beginning in terms of the practical and technical aspects of things. They had built a circular stage, which was divided into a semicircle, i.e. the front half of the semicircle would be the first band, and the back half would be the second band, and the whole thing was on wheels. So you would pivot the whole thing and swing it around after the first band had finished. They did that for the first band, and all the wheels broke in the first turn. So that never happened. The communications between the truck, which is where I was in a tractor-trailer truck, in the back end of a tractor-trailer truck in a sort of a 10 by 10 area with two 8-track machines, both of which were in orange crates to support them, a 12-channel console, with three Shure mixers and virtually no communication with the stage. So it was done by hand signals and people running back and forth. It was kind of crazy. I just remember I ran out at one point to see the audience and to see what it looked like. I think this was late in the afternoon of the first day. And it was just a sea of people. By this point, of course, the fences had come down. We must have been 350,000, 400,000 people. And I was standing next to a gentleman who I had tremendous respect for, named Bill Graham. And he turned to me and said, you know, Eddie, if these kids riot, we're dead. I said, thank you very much, Bill. I'm going back to my truck now.
Here we go.
another long-lost gem, Lover Man, from Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock. When we return, you'll hear the previously unreleased encore from Hendrix performed as the final song of the historic original Woodstock Festival. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock.
This is Eddie Kramer. I was Jimi Hendrix's engineer and producer, and you're in the studio with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock.
Thanks, Eddie. I'm Redbeard. Despite the crush of hundreds of thousands of concertgoers, the rain, the sea of mud, the crude recording equipment, and the technical problems, the entire set of Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock has miraculously survived and been lovingly restored by Eddie Kramer and John McDermott.
And I'm just grateful that we were able to get back to those original tapes that Kramer recorded in the truck in 1969 and put them together in sequence as Jimmy played them. And present to fans the best of his Woodstock moments. I mean, I think that for many years, the Woodstock album and movie kind of crystallized Jimmy's performance, the Star Spangled Banner and Purple Haze particularly, as the highlight of that original festival. I think for many, many people, their memory of Woodstock and Jimi Hendrix is intertwined. So it's an important release for people. It's a touchstone for people of Jimmy's generation, and I think for young fans, they look at it. It's one of those iconic moments where they're saying, you know, if I get one Jimi Hendrix live album, it's probably going to be live at Woodstock. You can, in fact, argue that there are greater Hendrix performances, but I think that fans, you know, for some reason, just the link between Jimmy and Woodstock is so strong that they think that that's the one I got to have.
Yeah. just say the name of the group one more time. This is the first little gig. We'd like to say thank you very much, man, for letting us in your ears, in your hearts. And the name of the group is the Sun and Rainbows. And, you can call it Band of Gypsies, anything you want. Let me call again. The guy with the purple pants on playing covers over there. That's Juma. Then we have Larry Lee with a headscarf around his face. And we got Billy Cox playing bass on the other one. And then Mitch Mitchell. And we have Jerry Vallette. Sweet time. I'll give it right back one of these days.
Tried to do was to recreate the event and let people hear what Jimmy performed. We started with Message to Love because that's what he walked on stage and did. And at the time, it was known as Message to the Universe. It's a great track that obviously evolved into a studio version, which we put out on an album called South Satin Delta with the big band, and that Jimmy later refined and put much more of a funk groove into with the Band of Gypsies. It's always been one of the great tracks from that album. Spanish Castle Magic by The Experience, I think, was wonderful to hear it in that expanded arrangement, which gave Jimmy a lot more freedom to solo and to try different things. And the other unreleased tracks that we were able to put in, we wanted Lover Man because it was a great concert song Jimmy played really throughout his career, right up through some of his final performances. Loverman was always a part of the set list, as was Foxy Lady. Billy Cox always felt that Jimmy enjoyed playing that because it gave him an opportunity to do his stage routines and play the guitar between his legs and behind the head and do all of what he felt like doing at that particular concert.
just jamming, that's all. You can leave or you can clap.
Yeah.
kiss this guy.
Hendrick's biographer and producer, John McDermott.
And we restored the encore, which was so rare for Hendrick's, when he came back out and did Hey Joe, in a way for thanking the crowd for sticking with them. You hear many of his comments in the CD, where he's in some ways almost apologizing for the loose feel, you know, and the fact that they're just put together for this gig. And I think in the end, he wanted to try a song called Valleys of Neptune. They didn't quite have it, you know, and he didn't feel he knew the words enough well enough to do it. So he reverted to the song that I think he really knew they wanted to hear and left them with a positive feeling about the performance.
Thank you.
Fittingly, the song that launched Jimi Hendrix's career in England was the one he left them with to bring the legendary Woodstock Festival to a close. The echoes of that weekend still reverberate through popular culture. I'm Redbeard.
And this postscript on Jimi Hendrix live at Woodstock 50+. Here's the late great drummer from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, Mitch Mitchell, who was retained after the Experience broke up to perform brilliantly, as you just heard, with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. Here's Mitch in the studio.
Thing was, there was still a lot of concerts to do as the Experience, as a three-piece. And not long after that, when changes did go down, we did a band with more pieces. We did the Woodstock Festival with more pieces added, but that didn't feel that comfortable either, or that it was just the wrong band. So consequently, Jimmy and myself, we just went back to the three piece, but that time with Billy Cox, and that was coming towards the end of for the last year. And that band that with Billy Cox, myself and Jimmy, was quite a bit different from the Experience. I've got fond memories of that particular band. It was quite powerful in its own way, in a much different way musically than the original Experience. And the Experience thing put a lot of pressure on Jimmy that he didn't like, which he created himself, getting known for burning the guitar and the rest of the wild, inverted commas, wild show that went with it, because people did expect, that they the word got around that, he's going to play his guitar with his teeth and behind his back and this, that and the other. And that gets very boring. That's a cross to bear Jimmy had to live with. And, I know, it's his own monster. We weren't questioning what was going on or what was not going on and how we were being ripped off one way or another financially, because we were just working. Until one day that it does, break upon you that maybe everything isn't quite as it should be. So consequently, to answer your question, when you hear you've got a number one album in England, what should be a glorious event, you're so burnt out and darn tired at that time. It doesn't really mean too much, quite honestly. At that period of time, if there's something in the infinite wisdom of the management, if there'd been any sense, there should have been a break and, some downtime. I mean, it got a little bit better towards the later stages for working, where we would go out and just play just work at the weekends without, it wasn't like stupid traveling all the time. Yeah, well, it was madness, but, by the same token, the bands that had toured prior to us, like the Animals, and the Dave Clark Fives and whatever, I mean, they went through all those Greyhound bus tours as Jimmy had done on the Chitlin circuit, where, if you don't make the bus, you're out of the band for I Can See the Sun, and they pick up another guitarist next stop. He'd served, he paid his dues in America on that circuit. I'd done a similar kind of thing in Europe as well. We had the all-nighter sessions over here as well. Noel had been out in Germany, and that amounted to little more than slave labor as well in those years. But that's what you did, And so people tend to forget that, Like, we, as the Experience, we worked our guts out for the short time the band was together, for those 2 years. But prior to that, for, 8 years or whatever it was, prior to that, we'd all been grafting, for doing all kinds of hours that God sends. But the management, they just wanted more. And it should have been, there weren't any Betty Fords around in those days. You know, it was really clean up. It would have been a bright move to take it easy, clean up your act. Come on, let's think about, what you're doing. Just too much lunacy. And it catches up in the end, or can do.
That was Jimi Hendrix drummer John Mitch Mitchell, who went from the Jimi Hendrix Experience to performing live with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock Festival, August 18, 1969. Mitch Mitchell died after performing a Jimi Hendrix tribute tour in November 2008 in America. God bless his sweet soul. I'm Redbeard, thanking my guests Billy Cox, Eddie Kramer, and especially Hendrix biographer, producer, and keeper of the faith, John McDermott. In the studio is copyright 2020, Bearded Fish Productions, all rights reserved.